I'm Millie.
I'm Chris.
And this is Beggar's Belief, home of scams, shams, hoaxes, pranks, and charlatans. Stories that you shouldn't believe because someone is not telling the truth.
That's two in a row.
Yeah, it's slightly different each time for the second half.
I appreciate that.
I'm getting close.
Yeah, we're getting there.
Yeah, we might actually have something going here. Or we might not, and I'm just delusional, which I accept.
That might also just be the point of the podcast sometimes.
You know what? So. Melanie's Delusions, the podcast.
Yes, there we go. Let's say it for what it is.
Too much Let's Pretend. One didn't have any Let's Pretend, and then one you were me.
Yeah.
So this is going to be back to Let's Pretend.
Let's Pretend? I don't have jelly shoes this time.
You don't have jelly shoes, okay. No. In fact, it is just turned 1970, so right. You're not quite, too little bit too early to have goldfish in your shoes, but you know.
Right, yeah, but you know what? Maybe I was the first person. Yeah, there you Somebody go. Had to do it.
So you work at a major publisher named McGraw-Hill.
Okay.
You know where we're going already?
No, I just know McGraw-Hill. That's all I need to know.
This was before they kind of made the shift to textbooks and education that they did later. They were more just a general publisher at the time. Yeah. So you're looking at books that you're considering printing, publishing, taking on. There's an autobiography penned by a 101-year-old Sioux chief. There's a biography of George Bernard Shaw penned by his wife. There's an in-depth biography about Lawrence of Arabia, and you just got a word that an author who has worked for you many times before has gotten permission to ghostwrite the autobiography of Howard Hughes. Would you have known which one was the scam? He's really thinking.
I would say the autobiography of Howard Hughes.
You are right. However, it's actually kind of a trick question because the first one was
also a scam,
which we will be doing in a later episode.
All right.
But today we're doing the autobiography of Howard Hughes, yes.
All right.
And this all ends with jail time and a Time magazine cover that says Con Man of the Year.
So could we call it Jail Time magazine?
You could, but you would probably be put in jail for that pun.
All right, yeah, fair enough. All right, let's go.
There has to be some punitive issues for bad puns.
Yeah, all right.
So before we get into the con, let's talk about the actual life of Howard Robard Hughes Jr., who is a fascinating figure, and correct, knowing a little bit about him will help.
Yep.
He was born in 1905. His father started the Hughes Tool Company when Howard was 4. This allowed Hughes to get a great education, but he lost both parents when he was in his late teens. At this point, he inherited the majority of the estate. He developed an interest in planes and flying, married a woman named Ella Butts Wrights, and moved to Los Angeles with an interest in films while still managing the tool company. He was known as a businessman, but in California, Hughes financed a series of films, many being nominated for Academy Awards. In the late 40s, Hughes Tool Company acquired ownership of RKO Studios, radio stations, and a series of movie theaters. He fired most of the staff, cut the number of films being produced drastically, and produced most of them himself. He worked with Janet Leigh, John Wayne, Jane Russell, but with a series of lawsuits brought against him by various shareholders and later a federal antitrust case, he eventually did pull out of the motion picture industry. Yeah. Hugh had a bigger contribution to aviation.
Correct. Yes. I've seen The Aviator.
Oh, yeah. I love that movie.
I really do enjoy that movie.
I love that movie because of the use of color, too.
Yeah.
And, you know,
the cinematography is great.
Yes. And DiCaprio.
Yeah. It peaked.
Sorry. That's one of my favorite, like, actual roles.
DiCaprio. Yeah. No, I agree.
You know. Anyway, thanks to his love of flying, he financed several state-of-the-art custom aircrafts, set world records for speed and distance, including a later record for a round-the-world flight. He also got a job at an airport under a fake identity, which I didn't know. Literally started as a baggage carrier and worked his way up to co-pilot.
What?
Just for shits and giggles.
Is this also the story of Catch Me If You Can? Like, no, what are we doing here?
I didn't know that one, and I actually kind of respect him a little bit more for it. In 1932, he founded Hughes Aircraft Company, put him in place to build aircraft for World War II. He later acquired TWA, Northeast Airlines, and Air West. In 1968, the Hughes Tool Company had purchased the Las Vegas Air Terminal. Hugh himself also survived 4 airplane crashes. Sustained major injuries, and actually beats my family for the number of...
I know that record.
Meanwhile, Hughes had been buying up property and real estate, a bunch of business maneuvers. After his divorce, he was known to date a lot of famous women. Katharine Hepburn, Joan Crawford, Betty Davis, Ava Gardner, Hedy Lamarr, Ginger Rogers, Gloria Vanderbilt, Mamie Van Doren, just to name a few.
Wow, I ran out of fingers.
Yeah. Oh, and that was like, that was kind of me pulling my wood list off of the list of people he actually dated. Jeez. Like, it was, yeah. He later remarried. However, a friend quoted that, "I don't think Howard could love anything that did not have a motor in it."
I mean, okay, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. He was known as a financial and contract genius, such as maneuvering to make his aircraft company legally tax-exempt charitable organization by using another business of his, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and managed to do some maneuvering, and suddenly he's not paying taxes. By the late 1960s, Hughes was one of the most wealthy men in America. He also loaned money to Richard Nixon, and it kind of got him tangentially involved in the whole Watergate thing.
Someone's a crook.
Well, it's the 60s. A lot of people were. So there's a lot of reason to be interested in Hughes from the culture, you know, pop culture at the time, the public was. But his actions later in life made him more bizarre. By the time our story starts, Hughes had refused any interviews for over 15 years. He was always known as eccentric, but he started to live as a recluse. Fairly early, he went to screen a movie and just didn't leave the room for 4 months, eating only chocolate bars, chicken, and milk. And that was the start, kind of his downward spiral.
I would say so.
Yeah.
Because, like, I've done that, but it's only for, like, a week.
Chocolate bars, chicken, and milk?
I'm from the South.
I don't know if I would stop pooping or never start
pooping. No other context. Let's move forward.
He was known eventually to just sit surrounded by Kleenex boxes, attended to a staff who weren't allowed to look at him, and was usually naked while he watched movies.
Okay.
I don't know if that's living the dream or living the nightmare.
Depends on who you ask.
Depends on the movie, too. This behavior just increased. He pulled further and further out of the public life, communicating infrequently, spending more and more of his time naked watching movies and sequestered for a long period of time in his rooms. At one point, he refused to leave his floor of a hotel for the point that he just bought the hotel because it was easier. There were lawsuits brought against him in this time where he could have just basically cleared it up by showing up in person, notarizing something, or showing up in person and testifying, and he would not be seen. And it cost him millions.
Think of all the Kleenexes he could have bought.
So Hughes probably had OCD and probably suffered from allodynia, which causes extreme pain responses to things that don't actually cause pain.
No.
So it could have been his clothes, the act of bathing, could have just been excruciating to him. He was also suffering with increasing mental issues. He had neurosyphilis.
Mm.
We almost need a bell every time I mention syphilis.
Honestly.
Watching movies might have been the only thing that could have distracted him from his pain, along with an increasing addiction to codeine. He was unwell, physically suffering, and there was very little that made it about him out to the public, but they ate everything up.
Yeah.
So, two authors named Clifford Irving and Richard Susskind had an article that basically just said he had moved from one hotel room to another, and this had made major news. And they were like, wow, if this makes major news, people will eat up anything. So their first plan was, let's write an unauthorized biography of Hughes. But then they seized on a different idea, because they would make a whole lot more money if they created an autobiography.
Yeah.
So they were going to claim that they were greenlit by Hughes to do this autobiography, and they really doubted that Hughes was going to protest because he was...
He hasn't taken action on anything else, so why would he come out for this?
So, a little background on our two co-conspirators. Richard Susskind was born in New York City, served in the Army at the Battle of the Bulge in World War II, and had authored several books. He was struggling financially as an author. At the time, he was trying to write a biography of Richard the Lionheart, but didn't know how to proceed because he knew publishers in the late 60s wouldn't go for the rampant homosexuality.
Fair enough.
Yeah, fair not really. Enough. Yeah. Clifford Irving was a published author. He had been working as a correspondent for NBC in Israel and saw the Six-Day War in 1969, and afterwards wrote a book about the battle, including interviews with the soldiers and photos. He taught at UCLA Graduate Extension School in 1961, and one of his students was the actor Cary Grant. At the time of all of this, he was married to a woman named Edith Sommer, who was a German artist, and he had two children. He was also having a fairly highfalutin affair at the time.
Yeah.
And he also had a pet monkey he won gambling.
Of course there's a pet monkey from gambling.
Yeah. He was best known at this time because his neighbor, he lived in Ibiza, and which I only know is that place where somebody took a pill in that one song. Yeah. His neighbor was Elmer DeHorry, who was an art forger. DeHorry asked him to write a biography, which he did based on research and interviews that he kind of ghost wrote into this whole thing. It was published as fake and as fake exclamation point in 1969.
Whoa.
And, we're actually going to be covering that in a future article that's already slated. That's going to be an episode at one point. So, off script here. I got some of this from other articles and articles and stuff, but I also read the book that Irving and Siskin wrote about their about the hoax. And I have to say, this is so... They make themselves up to be these golly gee shucks sort of guys who no one could have ever seen that this was going to go bad.
Gee whiz, mister. We were just trying to make a dime.
Yeah, and there was also a lot of, like... His wife is less an accessory to the crime and more a fashion accessory. Women are not treated well. It's very 70s. It's very... Yeah. So do not, at any given point, even though this was written very much, put him in as favorable light as possible. I seriously doubt it was nearly as favorable as he made it out. So... Irving decides he's going to sow the seeds to his publisher, McGraw-Hill, and it was the only publisher he worked with, and it was the only one they considered for this because they knew everyone there.
Right.
And they knew him because they had published so many of his books. He said he sent a copy of Fake to Howard Hughes and that Howard Hughes had loved it. Now, there's a lot to unpack there when you realize.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
So Hughes hadn't been seen in 15 years. Publishers were interested, and when they were, like, very interested in that fact, Irving claimed that they had more correspondence. Irving met with a publisher to work out a deal to do an autobiography, and he brought forged correspondence between him and Hughes.
I was going to ask if, like, any sort of, like, evidence of the correspondence was ever presented.
And basically saying that Hughes would be okay with it. Irving and Siskin, I'll just combine their name into one thing. Irving and Siskin had
That's
found...
That's my favorite ship.
Yeah, yeah. Had found out that Hughes always wrote on yellow legal paper with a fountain pen. So Irving created his forged letters on the same. The initial forged letters from Hughes were based on a print of a letter that was by him that was inset in a small little pic on a Newsweek article. It was only three sentences long. Irving tried to copy them and presented them to his publisher. The letter said that Hughes wanted the story told prior to his death, and he was avoiding traditional journalists and biographers because he wanted the truth to be out there. The wording in the letters was what really managed to convince the publishers at McGraw-Hill that it was real. Immediately after presenting these papers to his publisher, Irving found a longer letter that was written by Hughes and realized his forgery handwriting was awful. So he practiced that night getting the handwriting correct, rewrote the letters he had just presented, and showed back up with the new copies, and no one noticed that they had changed.
Oh my gosh.
So the publisher believed that the real man was on board. So they offered Hughes a $100,000 signing, another $100,000 upon completion of the transcripts, and a final $300,000 on acceptance of a finished manuscript and a preface by Hughes himself. This was going to be presented by Clifford Irving when he met face-to-face with Howard Hughes, and the whole situation was set up so that Hughes would never directly interact with the publisher. Irving was the go-between.
Yeah.
The contract was between the publisher and Irving, and Irving and Hughes.
Okay,
there's no direct. They had set it up. Hughes had no way to be contacted directly by the publisher.
Yeah.
So Clifford headed to Mexico, supposedly to meet with Hughes to finalize the deal. In the story, he told the publisher upon coming back, a mysterious pilot had picked him up, taken him to Hughes, who was touring ancient ruins in a Buick while looking like an ancient ruin himself. They talked, bonded, met the next day at a hotel where Hughes had accepted the publisher's offer. In reality, for all of this, Clifford messed up his bookings and had to come up with a reason that Hughes wouldn't be in his penthouse home where everyone knew him. So instead, he just went to Mexico with his mistress, and they just spent the days in their hotel room.
Not in a Buick looking at ruins?
No, there was no Buick. There was the ruins are actually there, but, you know, no Buick. No Buick. Just an actress named Nina who... Yeah. So the way the book was going to be written, and that the publishers had agreed, was that Irving would interview Hughes and their conversations would be recorded. Then these recordings would be transcribed by Hughes's secretary. Irving would return from the meetings with only these typewritten transcripts to show for it. And based on these typewritten transcripts would pen the autobiography, basically ghostwrite him. Despite the fact that Hughes was known to be an agoraphobic recluse, Irving decided to have them meet all over the place. Puerto Rico, Los Angeles, Nassau. Basically, he got the publisher to fund vacations. In the meantime, he worked the travel into the character that they came up for this fictional version of Hughes. In the book, Hughes was a world traveler, deep undercover. He's looking for deeper meaning in life as he travels around. And the McGraw-Hill, totally into it.
As far as scams go, I mean, more power to the for getting this far. Like, it's like if you give a mouse an airplane.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like anything else. Once you believe things, it's hard to stop believing things, you know? McGraw-Hill signed code words. Book was named Project Octavio, with Hughes being called Octavio. The autobiography with the company was kept on a need-to-know basis. And Irving, every time he came back, not only did he have these transcripts, he had these stories about the time he spent with Hughes, just the Hughes the man, and would regale anyone who was on the need-to-know basis. Like, he claimed that Hughes would fly to Puerto Rico specifically because he only wanted very fresh bananas. Like...
But that sounds believable. Like,
exactly.
I cannot, especially like this eccentric individual who he is with the amount of money he has. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, why mm-hmm. not?
And there was a lot of that where it was like, okay, you can totally see why. So with this basis in place, Clifford Early and Richard Susskind started researching Howard Hughes because they knew they would have to have as much facts as possible in place. They started by reading every biography on him that they could find. They used their time in New York City to delve through libraries, studying books on airplanes, pulling up old articles about Hughes on microfiche. They traveled to Virginia, read through articles from the Civil Aeronautics Board. This was in the middle of the protests of the Vietnam War. I want you to keep this in mind.
Okay.
Irving just got an appointment in the Pentagon under false pretenses and just walked right in.
If you do anything with enough authority.
He's given access to basically any file on Hughes that was not classified.
Excuse me?
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, height of the protests of the Vietnam War, and this dude just kind of shows up.
Right in.
And is like, hi, I am here to go through Pentagon.
Hi, we are Pentagon. Please come in.
Exactly. And apparently he got lost in the Pentagon, and everybody was like, oh, no, you're fine. Keep going that way. And at this point, he delved into the Library of Congress, just reading and studying. And at this point, this is where things start to deviate from somebody who is working on a biography is doing things ethically. Because, first of all, he's researching things that... I'm going to make up a story, but I want to have my facts right to make up the story. So he's researching those. And he is looking at Hughes's 1947 testimony in front of Senate and realized, this is a long volume. I don't have enough time to do this all. So he just stole the book by sticking it in his pants.
TLDR, put in my pants.
And apparently got partially frisked and still managed to get out. Yeah.
Oh, what's that you got there? Oh, it's not a book. You're just happy to see me. Go on out, buddy. Now keep going. You're going to get lost if you go that way. Yeah, the nuclear codes are down there.
But this is where I was saying, like, the book that he wrote about this is so written, it's written like it's fiction. And yeah. It's like, you don't know kind of how much to believe all the time, but there's that whole section. It's like 4 pages on him and this security guard. It almost reads like it's the beginning of a romance.
Oh my gosh.
Funny as hell. With, you know, Senate committee reports stuck in your pants. So he gets access then to the records of Time Life, and they are more complete than anything else he had actually found at the time. Records of correspondence, tales of personal life, accounts from people who had worked for and with Hughes. But all of this was unpublished, meaning that he had access to it, it was verifiable, but it was also not stuff that was common knowledge. It would add a lot of credibility to him. They did run into a snafu, because they were going to take all the money that the publisher was supposedly sending to Howard Hughes, and they couldn't deposit checks made out to Howard Robert Hughes.
Womp womp.
But they could have checks made out to H.R. Hughes. So they had a weird bit of luck. They have a lot of really weird
that
bits.
That seems to be a recurring theme here.
A luck, yeah. Edith, Irving's wife, had a mix-up with the Swiss consulate in Barcelona years prior. Because of marriages and divorces, she'd gone through several last names in rapid succession, and mailing the passports hadn't worked out. So she had a spare passport.
Like you do.
So she agreed to be part of the heist and created a false identity as an expatriate Swiss businesswoman named Helga Renate Hughes.
There it is.
They took pictures of her wearing a black wig, glasses, and dark lipstick, then bleached the original ink off the passport and carefully printed in new information and a new signature. She flew to Zurich and opened a Swiss bank account specifically to process these payments.
My God.
After the first check was passed, the first check made out for Hughes to just get started, Irving and Susskind happened upon a coincidence, another weird coincidence. They used one of their trips to take a detour to visit Susskind's aunt, who insisted they visit an old family friend. In this conversation, it came up that an acquaintance of this old family friend was looking for a ghostwriter for his autobiography. The family friend had a rough draft of what he wanted, and he was named Noah Dietrich, and for years had been Howard Hughes' best friend and right-hand man.
What?
Yes. And he just had this...
How do they keep stumbling into this?
Right?
It's like the universe is like, I want you to have this money. This money in particular, this X amount of dollars from McGraw-Hill, it's yours.
So he literally just had it sitting in his office and he hands it to them. They take it overnight, obviously make a copy, full of personal accounts, interesting stories about Howard Hughes, intimate details that had never been reported on for obvious reasons, like how Howard Hughes got gonorrhea, how he was punched out by somebody's husband, but there were also transcripts of Hughes talking, which gave Irving and Susskind the ability to replicate his speeches, his turn of phrases, and whatnot. Irving, he was like, after let him borrow it overnight, and like I said, they immediately went and made two copies. He brought it back. He's like, well, I can't take this on. The family friend's like, well, just don't tell Dietrich about this. I actually have this copy. I'm not supposed to have this copy. He loaned it to me and I made a copy just because I wanted to reread it. So he doesn't know that I was trying to help him find a biographer. So there's no record that they ever got this. Like I said, there were so many coincidences on this one. So they have all of this information, all of this research, so it's time to actually start writing the transcripts that would supposedly be these interviews with Hughes. The way they actually did this was they took turns playing the roles of Hughes and the interviewer. So sometimes one of them was Irving, some of them was Hughes, sometimes Susskind was playing Irving, They recorded themselves, and they just basically did really long-form improv. They expounded on these little snippets that they found in some of the papers. They wove in philosophy. They had this idea of the character of Hughes.
Yeah.
They wanted him to be this good character, understandable if incredibly eccentric, victim of bizarre life circumstances. As they had the fictional Hughes say, I'm an eccentric and make no bones about it. Eccentricity is a sign of superior intelligence. Ridiculing eccentricity is a sign of inferior intelligence. So they had these on recordings on tape, then they actually typed out the transcripts on a different typewriter than their publisher knew about it, and destroyed the original tapes.
Oh my gosh!
So they wove in a lot of their research into the story, and like I said, they would have just a little snippet of information, and they would turn it into a multi-page description that was very personal, very flow of consciousness, because they were doing it in this improv section. But they also made up a lot of stuff that totally didn't happen to Hughes at all. Such as, they created the role of an overbearing mother who would be the source of Hughes' germ phobia and sense of isolation. They said that Hughes had traveled through India on like this philosophical trip, developing a love for a country and a disillusionment of the West. There were kind of pop culture stories that Hughes was gay and they wanted to stop that. So they invented this tale where the then late actor Ramon Navarro sexually assaulted Hughes when he was a young man. And the fictional version of Hughes was said to be very disgusted by the encounter. They wrote about Hughes' time in Ethiopia. He was never in Ethiopia. Hughes was rewritten to be a war hero, flying missions over for reconnaissance over France at the behest of Roosevelt himself. They delved into Hughes' famous germ phobia, but they decided that Hughes would have a ranking method for the cleanliness of people, the way that you rank restaurants for cleanliness.
Oh my gosh.
Clifford Irving would be judged to be a B+.
That's like slapping an A on someone, a B.
Yes, exactly. They also decided he would be obsessed with organic food and have recently taken up yoga. Clifford cropped photos of Little Scene photographs and sent them to the publisher, claiming that they were gifts from Hughes. They created a long-term mentor-style friendship between him and Ernest Hemingway. No sign that the two of them ever met.
Yeah.
They said that Hughes had a series of doubles who helped to maintain his agoraphobic reputation, and that one of the doubles had accidentally been kidnapped. And then Irving claimed that in one of his meetings with Hughes, he got into a limo to find another man already there, then Vice President Spiro Agnew. And they just played up the whole loan to Nixon to a lot bigger of a deal than it was. Obviously, some of those are a lot higher ticket lies than others.
Correct.
They get these transcripts. Everyone higher up in McGraw-Hill, absolutely entranced. Gushing, they're all finding their favorite parts. The sections that they gathered from lesser known sources sold the realism of the less believable portions of the book. A handwriting expert was brought in, and he verified that the letters forged by Irving were actually from Hughes. Over the course of this, there's actually four separate times that the forged letters were verified.
Like verified four times?
Four times. This, like, kind of keeps happening throughout this come. So they're estimating what's their first edition needs, and they plan to publish around 500,000 copies of the books. They were already selling their printing rights. They threw high roller parties to announce that this book was being written, scheduled press tours, whole nine yards. So at this point, they still have the transcripts and they need to take this and turn it into a biography. Oh, right. So at this point, that's where they're working. So while Susskind and Irving are working on kind of creating this biography, you kind of have to wonder, because it's been public now, how long could they go on with the hoax?
That's what I mean. Like, and also they're getting much more open about mm-hmm. it. Like, you start having these press parties, these press tours, like, it's known.
And the book's not even written yet.
Yeah.
Really early on, before, like, much more publicized, there was an article in a newsletter that just mentioned that they were going to be writing this biography, and they knew that the real Hughes subscribed to the newsletter and was against publicity. And they were like, oh, this is the first we're going to be on his radar specifically. Right. McGraw-Hill also gets word that another man named Eaton had gone to a rival publisher with almost exactly the same promises, technique, and contract that Irving and Susskind had developed. Literally, someone else came up with the exact same hoax around the exact same time and went to a different publisher. There was, of course, to McGraw-Hill, because there's so much similarities, they thought that this person had managed to steal the transcripts.
Yes.
That was all they could come up with. There were other people who thought maybe that Hughes was playing, because Hughes is known for being such a manipulator, that maybe he was playing two different people off of each other, two different publishers off of each other. They didn't want to come out and say that the other one's a hoax, because Early and Susskind know as soon as they put that word out there, people are going to believe, well, why is ours not a hoax? So they're like, tactical distraction.
Yeah, coincidences.
So they had a series of telegraphs where they said that Hughes had said that the other autobiography was false, but that wasn't the important part. Ignore that other biography completely. Let's focus over here.
All right.
Hughes had found out that McGraw-Hill was planning to sell the rights to Life magazine to publish a shortened version, and Hugh was furious. He hated Life magazine, refused to work for Life magazine. If they had said anything about Life magazine, the whole project would have never started. The result, tried to redo the contract up to $1 million with all these stipulations, including rushing out the timeline of getting the book published, which would put them ahead of the other fake book.
Yep.
The publisher is rushing to try to fix this issue, and Irving and Susskind take the time to finish typing up some of the transcripts and working on that. And yeah, McGraw-Hill thought that Hughes had pulled this whole manipulative thing, and so they came out and gave an extra $250,000 to Hughes to placate him, and it was sort of a momentary distraction from everything else. The publication schedule is now being pressed up, and they're rushing to try to write this thing through. When the press had released that the autobiography was about to be published, Hughes Tool Company issues a series of denials about the project almost immediately. Irving responded by claiming that he was the one arranging one more meeting with Hughes, because we got to talk about this. Why is your company saying this? And that when he shows up, Hugh is on his deathbed, that this is people working outside of Howard Hughes because he's not able to work with them, concocts this whole story that, oh, the powers that be are manipulating this man who is too close to death to do anything. In reality, he's taking a paid vacation with a blonde scuba dive instructor who he had just met. Book is still being written. I cannot that this is before the book is even fully written. Irving is trying to hold out on convincing people of the lie until he had final checks cleared, obviously, at this point. Hughes himself reaches out to a journalist he had worked with in the 50s prior to becoming a recluse named Frank McCulloch. McCulloch shows up in the McGraw-Hill offices and demands to meet Irving. They shake hands. Cliff Irving and Richard Susskind literally run out of the building terrified. After they left, McCulloch does what Irving had never done and got the real Howard Hughes on the phone with the publisher sitting there. So, next morning, Irving sucks it up, shows back up, ready for the gig to be up, sits down at a meeting table filled with McGraw-Hill executives and McCulloch, and McCulloch is exhausted looking because he spent the whole night reading the autobiography. And this is a man who knows Howard Hughes as much as any other living person. And from his reading, he was absolutely convinced that Irving had indeed met and worked with Howard Hughes.
Are you kidding me? How does this individual keep tripping face first into the softest, cushiest walk pillows?
At some point you feel like you're just watching this guy, like, walking over, like, crackling ice, and, like, somehow, like, nothing's happening. He said, well, a lot of the facts were public knowledge. The language, the idioms of the books could only have come from somebody who had spent time with a billionaire. They end up talking and he's like, so how's he doing these days? And Irving completely talks about, and he's like, oh yeah, he was already starting to have that problem. I haven't seen him in, you know, 15 years, but he was already starting to have that project. Oh, does he still have this? Completely, completely believes him. So the question is, how the heck had this phone call happened? You know, because Hughes had on the phone denied ever working with or meeting Irving. So Irving convinces everyone, including McCulloch, that the man he had talked to was an impersonator hired by the people who are controlling Howard Hughes.
To have also this amount of, I won't even call it charisma, just the sheer audacity to take it to this extent. It's like, this must be true.
Yeah, he's just rolling 20s. He's rolling 20s.
How?
So at this point, an attorney acting in Hughes's interest came up, denied that the autobiography was real. Irving calls his bluff, saying that he's protecting his own interests because the contracts explicitly write him out of any financial benefit from this autobiography. So he got real ballsy and he says, well, if you really believe that, we'll both go and get a lie detector test. And the publishers at McGraw and Life magazine were like, great idea. And they arranged one. Somehow Irving got through with inconclusive results.
What?
At this point, Edith flies out, cashes the last check. They hid away some paper money and invested the rest under another bank account that was under another fake name in Switzerland. And when they got back, Howard Hughes called the first press conference in over 15 years. The reports were actually televised. Hughes is on the phone, though, and he's denying ever meeting Irving. That's the only purpose of his press conference. Irving still had believers because he goes, yeah, that's the sound alike that they're hiring. That's not the real Hughes. You know, maybe that's what Hughes sounded like when he was younger and well, but now his voice is so weak and, you know. Instead, McGraw-Hill publicly announced they had a wealth of details, documents, and evidence that the autobiography was real. The discussion of whether the book was real or not was so popular it made headlines over the Vietnam War. They scheduled Irving to appear as a guest on CBS's 60 Minutes.
Oh my gosh!
Which, in late 60s, early 70s, that's the biggest show ever. Mm-hmm. The date of the publication was kind of coming up. They're still working on finishing up the books, and this fleet of lawyers for everyone just descends on the scene. And that's when things finally kind of stumble out of control.
So, whoops, how do we handle this?
Siskin and Irving were asked to sign affidavits, and they start pointing out nitpicky details. Mm. So Siskin and Irving, neither of which live in the United States anymore, both decide it's time to go home to their international.
Yes. Yeah.
So they're going home to Spain and Ibiza, and let's just run away. You know.
I left the oven on. Exactly. Be back in a little while.
Police at this point are working with Howard Hughes's private security force, not just in the United States, but in Switzerland and in Ibiza and everything. They tracked down the Swiss bank account, found out that the person running it was definitely not Hughes, but a woman. Despite Edith using a disguise, they actually had a fairly accurate description of her. Meanwhile, real Howard Hughes is filling out affidavits that he had never met Irving and that the autobiography was fake. He added his fingerprints to the affidavit to verify his identity. So McGraw-Hill took the forged letters that they had in their possession and sent them out for fingerprinting, and there are no fingerprints on it, but they thought, they were like, oh, too many people have handled these. Why didn't we keep these, like, pressed in glass?
Right.
They still believe him. Meanwhile, in Ibiza, where Irving worked, people who were probably hired by either journalists or Hughes broke into his house and ransacked it. Edith was being threatened and followed around while she had her kids, so they decided to return to New York City. At this point, the district attorney, a United States attorney, and the United States postal inspectors were investigating the case. They interviewed him relentlessly, and Irving
realized, when the USPS gets involved, you've gone too far.
Well, that's, some of this evidence is actually at the Postal Museum in Washington, D.C., which I think is fascinating. Like, the Postal Museum, I swear, they have the weirdest, most random stuff. I love that museum.
All right, that's future trip.
Future trip. Yeah, Irving realized at this point is, no matter how he spun the tale, fraud had been convicted. He was trying to get Edith out of it, then he was trying to, like, lesser the offense for Edith. It just doesn't work. Edith is facing extradition to Switzerland and fraud charges in the United States. His kids are freaking out. Finally, he just breaks. Tells the lawyers. Tells the truth to his lawyers. Lawyers go into damage control, and everything kind of falls apart. Details are being picked out. Stamps on car rentals aren't matching up. Bookings in hotels aren't matching up. he's describing the number of seats of an airplane and it's incorrect. Little things like that are adding up on the outside. But one of the biggest pieces of evidence was from Irving's mistress, who had willingly testified that she'd been with Irving in the times that he claimed he was meeting with Hughes. And she totally just embraces the publicity to advance her acting career. Appears on all sorts of television shows. And the funny thing is, like, Irving in the book is just totally shocked that she would
do this.
Yeah. Like I said, it's he doesn't have, he's dead now, but he didn't have.
I tried to commit a fraud and I didn't get away with it.
One of Irving's other affairs with the scuba diver is dug up by reporters. Edith has a total breakdown and ends up clocking Irving out cold in the lawyer's office.
Good job. Honestly, good on her.
Irving and Siskin actually stood together. They did. They had hoped that they would turn against each other, and they didn't. And that's probably the only thing I can say in their favor is friendship.
So then you had two people going, wah-wah!
Exactly.
We tried to commit fraud. Wah-wah!
And they actually tried to take a plea deal to keep Edith out of prison. It didn't really work, but they tried. Time magazine has Irving on the cover. Like I said, con man of the year. Both the United States and Swiss governments blocked access to any bank accounts they had. They had no access to money. Prosecution, their biggest thing when they start going into this, even though he's admitting to doing it, they did not believe that he hadn't worked with an outside forger.
Yeah.
Because they were like, this is too well done. And like I said, it passed four.
Right.
So in the court, they had him write out a letter in Hughes' handwriting. And they were just kind of astounded. One of those letters actually ended up framed outside the U.S. courthouse building.
Oh my gosh.
And I believe that's one of the ones that's in the Postal Museum. Don't quote me on that one.
All right. We'll have to go see for ourselves.
Yeah, I'm good with that. We can also see this Hope Diamond while we're there.
Correct.
Yeah. So Clifford Irving pled guilty, was sentenced to 2.5 years. He owed over $1.5 million to his publisher, the IRS, and his lawyers. Irving declared bankruptcy, obviously, in 1972, and he was paroled out in 1974. Richard Siskind was sentenced to 6 months in jail. Edith spent 2 months in prison in the United States, then 2 years in a prison in a Swiss jail before she was paroled as well in 1974, and they divorced sometimes afterwards, but I couldn't actually...
I'm so shocked.
Yeah, I know. Wow. That just... When you will commit international fraud, but, like, you're lying about your mistress, it's kind of...
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. McGraw-Hill wouldn't touch the autobiography, obviously, after that. In 1977, Irving did publish a book titled Project Octavio, which outlined the story of how the hoax came to be. It was ever later re-released under the name The Hoax, which was in conjunction to a movie loosely based on the story where Irving is played by Richard Geard and Siskin is played by Alfred Molina.
I need to look up. I've never heard of this.
I hadn't either.
Especially because I love both those actors. How have I not?
The funny thing is when I ordered this, I had gone in for the original one off of Interlibrary Loan and they sent me the re-release.
Yeah.
And it has Richard Gere on the cover. And I went to pick this up and I'm like, what? Why is Richard Gere here? Richard Gere has randomly entered the picture.
Richard Gere was the real fraud along the way.
Exactly. Irving went to publish several books on online platforms because most publishers wanted nothing to do with him for obvious reason. He had nuked a lot of friendships in this process, obviously. He did have the autobiography printed. I got a copy again, Interlibrary Loan, flipped through it. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating how much they massage the facts, what they do in order to make Hughes always come out in a positive light and other people come out in a negative light. Like, there's a lot going on
and
there.
Just the fact that McGraw-Hill, these publishers, these people that had been in this industry for a very long time were so doe-eyed through the whole process. And I can understand why, though. Like, again, it's the prospect of this is Howard Hughes. This, if true and publishable, will be the biggest release potentially like of the century that we could have here. Why not believe it?
Mm-hmm.
Why not believe it until we can't?
This is a guy who has done multiple novels, but also multiple factual based books on, you know, war correspondence and on biographies. There's no reason.
Why would he lie?
They had a 10-year relationship, business relationship with this person, you know? So in 2014, the Briscoe Center for American History at the University of Texas acquired all of Irving's personal letters and papers, including everything about this. Irving died of pancreatic cancer in Sarasota, Florida at the age of 87 in 2017. Howard Hughes had already passed away in 1976, and I apparently didn't write down when Siskin passed away. I know I had looked that up at some point. It doesn't matter.
But Siskin is also gone.
Yeah, pretty much everybody in this story has passed on, except for Richard Gere.
Right, yes, and Alfred Molina.
Yeah, which my grandmother would be very... My grandmother had a mild crush on Richard Gere.
So. I mean, me too. Honestly, Mothman Prophecy is the best work he's ever done.
I accept that. But I've also told you my Mothman story.
Yeah, you have. Yeah.
But
wow, what did I? My brain just went through a lot of speed bumps, sudden stops, jug handles, and a couple of like barrel rolls. Like
the funny thing for me was, I read this on multiple sources. And at first it was like, oh, well, you know, this is why this is, oh, here's where it's going to fall apart. Oh, it didn't fall apart. Oh, this is where it's going to fall out. Oh, it doesn't fall apart. Oh, they stumbled into this thing they shouldn't have. And I'm rereading it in his own words. And I'm still expecting it to fall apart when it doesn't fall apart and not to work out when it does work out, because it's just, it was so unlikely that it would have succeeded the way it did. Yeah.
What? I need to see this. I need to see the movie. I need to read like the hoax, and I need to see the film, because this is just fantastic. I want to see how they dramatize.
Apparently, Irving was not really happy with the take that the movie got.
Yep.
He felt it was too fictionalized, a lot of the stuff, but I'm like,
oh, really? Whoa! You are complaining that real life events were too fictionalized?
The man who basically created the character of Howard Hughes through a massive improv session.
There's such like a movie in a movie in a book in a movie here to be done. This is how you get metafiction. This is great.
Yeah.
You did it.
Well, apparently they also had a whole lot of trouble when they were going back through then. It's like, well, this section here, how much of it is made up, how much of it was fact. Right. And they really had a lot of issue just kind of separating those two things.
Well, yeah, again, because especially like being so deep in this and invested and trying to get everyone else invested, I can absolutely understand at the end of the day how so many of these sections and moments and scenarios become blurred.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And there was a lot I had to cut out. Actually, I cut a good third off of the, like, there's entire subplots I had to cut out, which are even, again, unbelievable, because I just didn't want this to go on for hours.
But we'll talk about those over drinks at some point.
Works for me. Read the books.
Read the books. Read more.
Always read more.
Support your local libraries.
ABR. Always be reading.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's... That one was a wild one. And I was completely not aware of this at all. I'm sure if I had been around in the late 60s, early 70s, I would be. Right. But somehow this one had completely...
This is, the first I've ever heard of this.
Yeah.
And this is, like, something that would, like, fit right in my pocket that I'd love to, like, find and go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
So that's why we did it today.
Yeah. Congrats.
Especially from this side of the microphone. Do not believe everything you hear or read, especially if it's from McGraw-Hill.
They're out of business, so you can say that. They got acquired. They went educational and then they got acquired.
Yeah, especially. Yeah. This is Beggar's Belief. And don't forget, you can find us on Instagram at Beggar's Belief Podcast and on all major podcasting platforms, Beggar's Belief. If you have any stories you want to tell us, comments, feedback, 5 stars, no less, you can email us at beggarsbeliefpodcast@gmail.com.